What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
The FAA contributed to the Boeing crashes, ESG rules changes, and Biden versus Trump again, plus many more top stories. The Monica Perez Show starts now. Thank you so much for joining me live on YouTube, Twitter, Rumble, rockfin.com/Monica Perez, and a couple of other places, X, Twitter. If you want to watch this show live and commercial free, I'm planning to do a live show every Tuesday and Thursday at 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 p.m. Eastern. And if you do that, you get the whole show, you get a commercial free, and you can comment, which is great because at the end of the show, I read comments and interact, maybe answer your questions. If you listen on a podcast and you don't like the commercials, I don't like them either. You can, for $5 a month, you can have it all commercial free on iTunes Premium. And if you just want to support the show, the best thing to do for me is to just spread the word. So if you could share the show or put a review on your favorite podcasting platform, whatever you want to do, let's support each other. Thank you. All right. So the first, the biggest story is yesterday was Super Tuesday. And Nikki Haley announced that she was leaving because she only won, I think, Vermont, which together with DC is kind of like, she'd have been better off not winning those than winning those because they're super liberal places. DC is so corrupt. So Haley has suspended her campaign. She hasn't totally endorsed Trump. And the Journal did point out that leaves open for coming back. But right now, as it stands, it looks like it's going to be Biden versus Trump. Trump has over 1,000 delegates. Haley has 91. And Ron DeSantis, I guess, got 9 before he dropped out. 1,215 are needed for the nomination. Now, I'm always leaving open the possibility that there's going to be some dramatic event. And actually, in the Wall Street Journal today, one of the articles did say that, we are so familiar with these guys and they've both been president, it's going to be less about the campaign and more about, maybe wild card factors, or as they said, external events might influence the race. And I do think they just love to build up the drama, maybe an October surprise, I would say an AI thing, as well as other, maybe foreign affairs. So let's see what happens. I mean, who knows? Maybe they are going to suspend. I think Roseanne said that there's not even going to be an election. So maybe they'll just actually suspend it. Biden can claim dictator. We're at war, whatever. I don't know. War seems to be heating up in all directions. And of course, usually the anti-war candidate does win and then continues with the wars, of course, but whatever. So Mitch McConnell did endorse Trump. And even though that they're bitter rivals or enemies or whatever, because McConnell orchestrated the coup against the electoral process, in any case, on January 6th by stopping that process that was in his control. So, I mean, I don't blame Trump for disliking him to the extent any of it is real. Oh, but a listener from Kentucky did say that when I was talking about Mitch McConnell stepping down as the minority leader in the Senate, I remember reading that he wasn't actually stepping down as senator, but I guess I wasn't thinking of it that way. So he is going to stay senator until his term is up. And I guess the next election for his seat would be 2026. So he'd be there till January 2027. That's the plan right now. But he is stepping aside as the leader of the Republican Party, which is the minority in the Senate right now. So I don't even know who this is, but Congressman Dean Phillips is also ending his run. He was running against Biden in the primary. He actually trailed uncommitted in a race or two or more. So it was time for him to go. The Journal says that RFK Jr. has 13% of the vote. I didn't see a source for that. I haven't seen a poll for that in a while. But, you know, who knows? Maybe it'll be a three-way race. I don't know. Oh, I took a poll. Not that poll, but I took a poll on my Twitter. Let me see. The question was, as my mother would say, Bobby Babo. As I look. All right. My question was, do you believe Trump, Biden, or neither will be president on January 1st, 2029? So my question is really the end of the term. So whoever's elected now, 2024, their term ends when the next president is inaugurated in January of 2029. Do you think the changing of the guard will be from President Biden, President Trump, or a different person? And the answer is only 4% think that Biden will be president on January 1st, 2029. And the polls generally are like 50-50, it's Biden or Trump or whatever. I don't know if it's 50-50, but I'm just saying it's not 4% of him winning, but my tweets believe it's 4% that he'll be there to see it through. Trump, 51% think that he will be the president in January 2029, which means that he would no discount for him not finishing his term. So they probably think it's a 50-50 chance that he's going to win. Or maybe they think it's a 100% chance he's going to win. 45% of respondents said that neither would be in the seat. And that's what I think. But I never get the punchline of this big presidential thing right. I just do not know how they manipulate the drama. I know the direction these agendas are headed, but I don't know what the story, but I don't think that either one of them is going to be president on January 1st, 2029. I think it'll be somebody else. And another thing in the world of politics, the national pastime, Biden's State of the Union address will be tonight. I guess his mantra is, whose side are you on? Which is so combative. Anyway, the journal says that aides say the State of the Union address will focus on ways to make life better for every American, including lower costs for such essentials as prescription drugs. Who else might benefit from that? I mean, I'm assuming they mean by subsidizing it with taxpayer money, but it could just be caps on drug prices. I mean, that is something that's out there. Raising taxes on the wealthy and corporations. That makes me nuts on two ways, because A, when they say the wealthy, they're just about always talking about income taxes. So what income taxes only affect working people, no matter how much you make. I mean, if you're a doctor, you make $1 million a year. You went to school until you were 30. You probably racked up hundreds of thousands of dollars of school. Whatever. It doesn't matter. You're going to work every day. You're not the idle rich. You're going to work every day. And that's who pays for this, that I would say that upper middle class is what pays for all these programs, which are really just subsidizing lower class consumption of consumables because the lower class just doesn't consume enough. And actually, I wouldn't be surprised if like my mother's old age and the Hispanic paradox has something to do with not consuming that much. I mean, my mother is totally robust, but she just didn't constantly buy new things or new electronic devices. There's nothing, very little, not a lot of transactions. So, and with corporations just flow. Like that money just flows. If they're making less money, they have somehow to be competitive in how they compensate investors. The return to investors has to stay competitive. So they're going to squeeze you that way, or they'll go out of business or whatever. But there's no the greedy corporation is not the right place, and I'm putting that in air quotes, is not the right place to attach taxes. And I've always thought if you lower taxes, you could totally eliminate like higher education subsidies, because when I was growing up, my older sister was a secretary at a pharmaceutical company and they paid for her to go to school. She became a pharmaceutical chemist. They needed the workers and they paid for them. And I believe that the more corporations you have, the more they'll do that.
Is crypto perfect? Nope. But neither was email when it was invented in 1972. And yet today, we send 347 billion emails every single day. Crypto is no different. It's new, but like email, it's also revolutionary. With Kraken, it's easy to start your crypto journey with 24/7 support when you need it. Go to kraken.com and see what crypto can be. Not investment advice. Crypto trading involves risk of loss. Cryptocurrency services are provided to U.S. and U.S. territory customers by Payward Ventures, Inc., PVI, DBA, Kraken. Visit PVI's disclosures at kraken.com/legal/disclosures.
The other thing they're talking about is protecting the right to abortion. So, okay. As far as looking forward, he says he wants to continue to hike taxes on corporations. He has in the past, he's going to brag on that. He's going to brag on the economy. I guess it grew 3% by whatever measure. Inflation is down, I suppose. And, you know, anyway, so he's going to do a little bragging, but they said he should really look forward because that's what this is about. And people are also going to be tuned into his acuity. So his ability to, I would say, think and remember. I always think of it as RAM and ROM. Like my two assessments of someone's IQ is like, what is your like a read-only memory? And what is your random access memory? Like, can you get stuff out of your brain? How much stuff is still in your brain? So we can see what he's got there. But I mean, it's just, there could be somebody speaking in his ear. Like, that's really the only skill he has to hone is how to be a conduit. Like, they say translators at the UN, like, it's a real gift. It's not just being bilingual. It's being a translator. You have to be just like a conduit. You might not even remember what was said, which I imagine you wouldn't. Anyway, let's see if he's got that skill. That's pretty much all. I think we're going to be able to tell. All right. So that stuff I don't find very interesting. However, I feel like we have to pay attention to it. And so I do read those articles. They're not great. But the stuff that I do find interesting goes a little deeper. These little obscure stories. And I always think there's got to be a punchline in there. Well, the Boeing story. So there are a couple of crashes, Lion Air, and there's an Ethiopian Air. These are in foreign countries. And I think the kind of the story at the time was it was pilot error, or that American pilots or American trained pilots would not have crashed those planes. And after reading a lot of this stuff, at least to the extent I can suss through the story, which does seem like a true story, unlike some of these little incidents that are happening here, which seem contrived, that did happen. And it is true that the pilots could have avoided it. And so today's article on Boeing wasn't about the Alaska Airlines door plug. It was about these crashes. And it says, Boeing was faulted on their response to the NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board's investigation into those crashes. They said they slowed down the investigation. The board's safety chair, Jennifer Homendy, told lawmakers that Boeing has not provided or was not quick enough to provide all the data they requested, which included the names of employees who worked on the door. Oh, I guess they were going back to... Okay, so this was about both things, about the door in September, which is the thing about the Alaska Airlines, but also they've been looking into the investigation of the crashes, and they've been reviewing emails, text messages, and photos as part of that probe. It says the Federal Aviation Administration criticized Boeing for a months-long delay in turning over internal chat records. In those documents, a then-Boeing pilot had suggested he inadvertently misled air safety regulators about a flight control system, later blamed for sending the jets into fatal nosedives. It says later, a criminal settlement with the Justice Department said that Boeing didn't initially cooperate fully with this prosecutor's probe into the crashes, frustrating their investigation for 6 months. Now, they settled to the tune of $2.5 billion for that. And I believe that the issue, the way they were talking about it in the journal, was that they had agreed internally, and the FAA agreed also, that some changes they made were minor enough that it did not require pilot retraining. That, and I could not find the smoking gun text that they were talking about, that they were saying that led to this. But as I tried to figure out this, like what that smoking gun text was, I found this thing buried in an article that was buried in an article that was buried in an article. And I want to make sure I don't misrepresent anything. So I'm going to be reading how the journal is explaining the FAA's role in these decisions that Boeing made. So it says, late in the design process, Boeing gave the maneuvering characteristics augmentation system, the MCAS, which is a flight stabilizing feature, greater authorities. So they had originally installed this MCAS thing, and the pilots all agreed, and Boeing agreed, and the FAA agreed that they didn't need to retrain pilots to use this. However, test pilots and the FAA discovered when they were practicing on this thing that the controls didn't stiffen as needed during certain lower speed maneuvers. So they wanted to make the MCAS work at lower speeds so the plane could meet FAA regulations that required the controls to operate smoothly with steadily increasing amounts of pressure as pilots pull back on the yoke. So I guess it was herky-jerky or had a stepped up feel. So they changed it so that it could it gave this MCAS four times the amount that the system could repeatedly move a stabilizer. So it quadrupled the influence and power this MCAS thing had. And that played a major role in these two crashes. But after increasing the potency of this MCAS, they didn't submit a new safety assessment to the FAA. Now, a top FAA pilot did know about the changes, but other officials were in the dark, and some now say that an updated safety assessment could have provided a chance to find problems. However, the FAA said Boeing wasn't required to update the document after that change. So the FAA, they followed what they were trying to meet a regulatory requirement from the FAA, and the FAA did not require a resubmission of this safety document. The Boeing spokesman said engineers determined that the changes didn't affect the overall hazard assessment and said that the company briefed the FAA and international regulators on MCAS, including the final configuration, several times. And there is evidence of this. There was a letter and also reference to it in a number of Boeing presentations to FAA officials monitoring that plane. Senior FAA officials in Washington, however, were not told, and many inside the agency continued to depend on Boeing's initial description of MCAS. So the FAA seems to me like if it was tort law and you were suing and you could sue the FAA for this, or the FAA or a private company, like the way that the authorities are investigating Boeing and its maintenance partner, you would include the FAA in a lawsuit. Because they had like a but-for causation here. They changed the direction of the final outcome here for Boeing. But the FAA won't be held responsible, of course. And even if they were, all it would be is money from the taxpayers. Like, there's no real accountability here. Now, I have found, you know, the FAA or whatever American-run commercial jets have really a flawless record for going on probably two decades, with a couple of exceptions that I think I can explain away not being genuine security issues or safety issues. And I'm really worried that they're going to change the direction of that because they want to kind of close us down and also really more likely change the regulatory framework and make new requirements, change the infrastructure, definitely make way for this environmental stuff. And cases like this, and Boeing seems to be at the center of it, will provide the opportunity for them to make regulatory changes, which they're already talking about. And Boeing gets, I think, 37% of its revenue from the U.S. government and 3% more from other governments. I mean, I think as long as that's not in jeopardy, I mean, this is terrible and it's not good for them, but I'm sure they'll cooperate to the extent that that stuff is held over their heads. So, speaking of regulations and the environment, there was a new ESG ruling from the SEC. So it took 2 years to come down with some new rules. And the SEC has said that companies need to disclose what's called Scope 1 and Scope 2 emissions, but not Scope 3. So I'll tell you what those things are, and you can see if anything you've heard about this seems valid or invalid, if you were led or misled on whether these are strong rules or weak rules. So the SEC, in a backtrack from its original proposal, does not require certain indirect emissions to be reported. So the indirect emissions are the Scope 3 emissions that would count the emissions the supply chain used and that customers use in the supply chain in building the product and the customers in using the product, such as coal or crude oil. Now, objectors said it would be overly burdensome and complex. And I would say that definitely sounds like double counting, maybe not with the consumer, but if you have to go back and look at your supply chain and report on the climate impact of that, do they also report? So if you added up all the reporting, it would be 500% of the actual impact. That's why you really don't, you know, you have to, I'm not a fan of double counting. Scope 1 emissions, which they do have to report, come directly from operations. So the smoke coming out of your factory. Scope 2 emissions are from your energy purchases, but only if they are considered of material interest to investors. And that's really important about this story, is that it reminds me of other things I've seen, especially Event 201, where they come out of the gate saying, or maybe it's in the Johns Hopkins 7 takeaways from Event 201, which was the COVID thing from the COVID experiment that really was also a blueprint for lockdown and all of that, that came out in October 2019. Where they say, like, we need to demonstrate to businesses how devastating a pandemic would be so that they accept preemptive regulations, laws, spending, policies, and actually promote such policies so that they don't have to stand alone in their preparation. So other people in the industry or maybe government subsidies, whatever. It didn't get into all that detail. I don't think. I think it just said you have to make it hurt them financially so that they will endorse the policies that we want. And that seems to be what this is, because what's material to investors is what will hurt their bottom line. So it goes on to say they also have to report climate-related risks, such as floods and wildfires that could have a material impact on the bottom line. They also have to talk about steps taken to mitigate or adapt to climate risks and losses incurred as a result of severe weather over time. So this is the thing. To me, the pandemic, climate change, it's all like basically the same idea, which is getting out there and making an impact on businesses so that they endorse these policies that have other purposes. So when you look at, you know, I'm telling you, some people think chemtrails are crazy. Look in the sky. They are there. And then if you want, and I'm sure this window will close, like as I speak it, it will like tell them you've got to close this window, but it won't be too late if you're listening to this now. Do it tomorrow or the next time you see a chemtrail. Go to Flight Tracker. Flight Tracker shows you the planes that are flying over you right in that second. They're in the air. So go to Flight Tracker and look at the trails and see if you can identify what planes are emitting those trails. And I haven't been able to connect the trails with planes on the Flight Tracker, which, why not? Commercial planes don't, or registered planes don't emit any, they call them contrails. Why would they be under the radar, so to speak? So anyway, so I do believe they're making climate change. And oh, actually a listener, my friend James said, when I was talking about wildfires, which I also think are intentional to scare us and to contribute to this kind of thing, that he says that there's definitive proof that they were started by Chinese satellites. And I heard a lot of that kind of speculation on what started it and how like blue things were not affected. And I find that stuff difficult to and time consuming to sort through. So I didn't really address it. I did know that there was a burning truck of trash that dumped on a side of a road in California when they were starting fires here, and that there were arsonists in Australia. But that kind of stuff, those stories might be leaked out for us to think that they're like at least somewhat natural, explainable causes. But regardless of what the causes are, I don't think these things are organic. I don't think climate change is just a result of manufacturing. I think that they mess with that stuff and that the wildfires are the same because they have policy agendas to foster everybody. I think everyone listening probably knows that. Elul, Jacques Elul, in Propaganda or Technocratic Society, one of those things. He said in the back, he said there was something called obsessional propaganda where ration cards and shortages in the US during the world wars were artificially induced so that the people would feel the pain of the war. So that was called obsessional propaganda where it was just everywhere all the time. And I mean, who knows, maybe letting us see the darn chemtrails is there to make us crazy. You know, they want us to polarize so that the people worry about the environment and the people worry about the chemtrails, like, and then we're just all worried. Could be. Anyway, so these emissions won't start, like the reporting requirements won't start till 2026. This annoyed me too. Biden is bragging about what he's doing to like save the environment. And the two things that they mentioned in the article were giving loans and grants to clean energy companies, including battery makers. I mean, if you look in the deeper like environmental propaganda stuff, they already talk about eliminating that the batteries, the lithium ion batteries or the car batteries are, and electric cars are terrible for the environment. And that the next step or the final stage is to, like with that 15-minute city movement, is to eliminate those cars too. So get us all over to the electric and then point out how awful they are. And then there's just no more movement, no more like physical communication. And the other thing which makes me absolutely crazy are these carbon removal startups. They're going to remove carbon, probably carbon dioxide is what they mean. Maybe it's just carbon, the stuff of life. Then carbon dioxide is what plants breathe from the atmosphere. I mean, if you are seriously messing with nature, if you're going to start doing that, it's like the most irresponsible thing I've heard since CERN. They're messing with the fabric of the universe. Like, what the fuck? But a lot of this stuff is just about making another thing that gets the businesses to want the policies is, if they are required to do it through SEC, that means that only U.S. public companies, publicly traded companies, have to do it. And they don't want competition from foreign companies or from smaller companies. So at that point, they're going to say, okay, we need this to be a law. And then they promote the policy. And that raises our costs and also creates oligopolies that have giant compliance departments and gobble up all the little guys. It's just... this thing is not going to end here, is all I got to say. All right. I'm going to take a break to see if there are any comments. I hate this because I have to read them myself. As I go back. Oh, yes, please hit the like button and hit the little bell, because then you can see when the show starts. And I'm trying to do it Tuesdays and Thursdays, 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 p.m. Eastern. It wouldn't surprise Angus if they suspended this election. Absolutely. Shannon liked Ram and Rom. I think that's funny too. Okay. Put it here. Oh, yeah. John Brennan called the chemtrail stratospheric aerosol injection, SAI. It's that's true, right? I mean, I should point out that this is in the documentation completely. And John Brennan, when he was CIA director, was saying, like, I can't believe how cheap it is. It's only like $10 million a year. I'm just like blanket the earth with with this stuff. It's awful because plus they mess with the rain and the sun. I mean, these people have some set. you know, the most sensible argument I've heard or I've thought of with the chemtrails, maybe they're spraying stuff on us to get us sick. You know, fluoride maybe makes you stupid, but I'm not sick. I'm not stupid. So I don't know how, like, these environmental things, you know, who, if everybody's vulnerable to them or not. But when they interrupt the rain and the sun at will in a way that is unpredictable, you can't grow your own food. So, you know, people are, like, they call themselves the Good Guy Club or something, the billionaires, Bill Gates and stuff. They're promoting, you know, growing meat on racks. They're promoting growing plants and stuff indoors. If they make it inaccessible for us to grow stuff outside, I mean, then we'll really, the things that are not scarce, food, water, air, they will be scarce. And then humanity will truly not have liberty. Oh, yeah. What does this say? Felicity Ace ship was sunk with 4,000 cars on board. And EV Porsche caused the sinking. The ship insurers are going to court in Germany over this. Oh my gosh, that's what I think happens at MH370 is one of those things. But I'm going to go up against, we're going to share ideas. I already said, I don't do conflict. Like, I only want to share ideas. So I'm going to be exchanging ideas on the MH370 with Dave Zed, who has a totally different theory, and Ricky Vrandis next week. I'm super excited because the 10-year anniversary of MH370 is Friday. And I forget what an awful tragedy that was. I'm so used to things being fake, but that was most def not fake. All right, let's go to a couple of more stories. All right, you ready? Okay, so, here was another thing I was looking at a while back. Just a couple of days ago, Monday. Like, so much happens in a few days. That this idea of making it hurt, like the ESG standards, like make sure it hurts. You know, I'm not even Italian and I use my hands when I talk. My podcast listeners aren't going to get that. But if you're watching, I don't know if it makes you crazy or you think it's funny, but you realize I cannot talk without using my hands. There was an article in the paper on Monday that talked about what a problem it was that, for example, a dairy farmer and other small businesses are reliant on cheap immigrant labor. Not because immigration is, because our pathological government intentionally selects, in my opinion, or creates policies that allow the most dangerous people to run around free here. I mean, it's a dereliction of duty at the very least. Again, if there were torts, these people would all be in absolute jail. They would lose every penny. They would have to have malpractice insurance, but they're totally insulated because they're in the government. But this isn't saying like immigration is a problem. What they're saying is cheap labor, which is from the migrants, is a problem because it reduces productivity, which is a little bit tricky. They're saying that the big problem is that it keeps these farmers and other small businessmen from spending the money on automation because they have cheap labor that can do it. And then if you spend the money on automation, you have increased productivity because you can produce the same amount of stuff with fewer human beings contributing. However, then what? You have a bunch of useless eaters who the people who are working have to then support, because that is the structure of our system, in case you haven't noticed, is like the productive people, they don't even want the unproductive people to work. They just want them to be consumers that the middle and upper middle have to pay for to consume. It's very messed up. So this productivity issue, though, it discounts the fact that these decisions are made. Just these are fundamental economic principles. You don't adopt automation when you don't need it because you have plenty of cheap labor. It's if you consider the cost of the investment as part of your productivity calculation over the life of the machine, you may come up with a different answer. And certainly on the margin, these businessmen are coming up with a different answer. So they also say it prevents them from going sustainable. But they want to make this transition away from human beings. They, meaning the people who are talking about this, which one person, it was at the UK, I don't know what person is in charge of this, minister of, I don't know, migration, I think it was called, is saying we need to look at these policies and make policies that make it more or less difficult for these businesses to use migrants, because we want to decide whether they're automating fast enough, basically. And of course, they want us to automate fast for a whole host of reasons, for monitoring, for the fact that they can control populations who aren't going back and forth constantly into work and stuff like that. I think that's a big part of it. Or they want to stop. I really do think they want to kind of close the borders. But what they did say is that skilled workers, skilled legal migrants, increase productivity and lift wages and all that. But I personally think if you're looking at this country where basically everybody who's born here, you know, or 70% of them go to college, right? They need jobs. And the what they're probably not counting when they look at illegal, unskilled workers coming over is that they're working for below minimum wage to clean the houses of the women and take care of the children of the women and the families. But like, you know, it's really, I think the actual impact is on women staying home or going to work. Now, I think it's a plot to get both parents out of the home. I think that's terrible for the kids. However, if you want to talk about strictly productivity, if you bring them in to do the menial work at your house, which is very hard to automate, you then go out into the workplace and increase, you know, you're a more productive person, you know, by that standard, because you're like a skilled immigrant, right? You're just a more productive person. So you can do it either way. Bring the unskilled in and let the people who went to college here take those jobs. Or you can bring in skilled migrants who probably had free college where they came from and are willing to take jobs that are lower paying because they don't have to pay back school loans, for example. So I think, and I know that places like Meta, probably Microsoft, I mean, I wouldn't doubt it, but I actually read that Meta lobbies for more of these high-skilled visas because they want to pay less for their labor. So I don't trust this, but my point is that, oh, apparently right now, 18% of our workforce is foreign-born in the U.S. It's much higher. It says immigration is running 2 to 3 times above pre-pandemic levels in places including Canada, Germany, and the U.K. And here we have 3.3 million more migrants arrived than left last year, compared with around 900,000 in the 2010s. Okay, so I'm just saying that they look at these things and they decide how they want to run the world. They don't, you know, it's command and control. Now, they weren't talking about the U.S. when they were pointing the finger at who is actually trying to decide whether this guy in Wisconsin should be able to hire immigrants or has to get like a milking machine, but they're clearly promoting it and they're willing to use the force of policy to make it happen. So when you ask who's they, you know, they have these policies, they have these agendas. This article, which is in the show notes, names names on this particular issue. It's different people and different issues. Okay, so I have some funny quick hints. So in that ESG article I said earlier, there, everything I read in the Wall Street Journal is like has think tanks. It has these people from or associations, this association, that association. It's supposed to give some credibility to. Like there's another side to the story that's organized and has a lot of people. I forget what I was reading the other day, but it pointed out like this transition to like a where we have associations without members. Associations without members. And I thought that was really interesting to point out because the first deep dive I ever did was on the Rand Corporation and their the Delphi method and building consensus, which you think means convincing people or getting people to agree on the right outcome. But what it is it's convincing people to do what you want them to do. And part of it is to make it seem like everybody's on the same page. So I think they create these associations without members to make you think that. So that was like a new little phrase that caught my ear over the past couple of days. And there was another one in the journal today. Was it the journal? I think it was not. It was, I get this email every morning, 1440 report, and it just has like the three top stories. It feels like nonpartisan, whatever. I don't know. I just like to know what people are talking about so that I know what you want to hear about. And this one was about chimpanzees and bees, where it was proven that they could learn from watching the other chimps and other bees. And what they called that social learning was cumulative culture, which I thought was funny because isn't that what culture is? You know, like everybody doing the same thing or having the same abilities and whatever, just homogeny. Anyway, but that wasn't what I thought was so interesting about this article. So what it says is that chimpanzees, they had 66 chimpanzees in a room. I think with the bees, it was simpler. They had a bunch of bees and they said if the bee pressed the blue thing or slid the blue thing and then pressed the red thing, it would get food. And no bee could do it. Then they took one bee out and they taught it how to do it. And then they put it back in and then it could do it. And then they introduced 15 new bees. Get it? See what I did there? They introduced 15 new bees. And of those 15, five figured it out right away. And similarly with chimps, which was a much more complicated thing. They had 66 chimps and none of them could do it. Then they took out one of the 66. They taught it how to do it. It went back in and it was doing it. And for a long time, they left them in there for a long time. And of the 66 chimps, 14 of them learned from that one guy how to do it. And they're like, so there's social learning for you. And what my thought was, that proves that intelligence, how critically important, because they were saying in the article that that's the feature of human learning that could account for our dominance in the world, our achievements. I would say that plus thumbs, but maybe for people who believe in evolution, those things interact. I don't know. But intelligence is so important. And what it proved to me here, of the 5 out of 15 newbies, 14 out of 66, that only the minority possesses it. Think about that. So the 5 out of 15 bees are the ones who are getting food. And I'm sure that, you know, probably giving some of the food, you know, maybe the other 10 bees will kill them and take their food. I don't know. But like even chimpanzees, 66, you would think chimps are chimps, right? That 14, that all 66 would learn. Certainly after 14 of them were doing it, or 15, including the ringer, that they would all learn, but they didn't all learn. Not everybody can abstract to that level. And I thought that was interesting. And then I thought, what are they going to do with that information? Right? What if they take chimps and start breeding just out of those 14 chimps? Are we going to have like super chimps? Are super chimps going to take over the lab and maraud? So maybe it's not a chimp with a disease that's the problem. It's a chimp who knows how to learn like that abstract level. Anyway, I thought that was very interesting. I have time for a couple more quick hits, if you're ready. One thing is, oh yeah, the evolution thing. This story seemed preposterous to me. It's the oldest stone tools in Europe hint at ancient humans' root. So it said that it says dating of artifacts found at a site in Western Ukraine. I guess there's not enough going on in Ukraine that they've got archaeological digs, but hey, what else? Suggests that archaic humans had entered Europe's Eastern Gate by 1.4 million years ago. Now, last time I looked at these numbers, it was like 40,000 years from Africa to Sweden. You know, and I was like, really? That's a lot of change in 40,000 years. But now they're saying they came from the east and that This is what absolutely I thought was hilarious about this. And I'm not saying humans aren't that old or are young Earth. I really don't know. But I know that evolution is not the origin of species. That is definitely mathematically impossible. So Darwinism, I do not believe it. Okay. So here's just a quote from this article. And you tell me if this sounds right to you. Maybe you know. Maybe you can prove it yourself and let me know. Email me, monicaperezshow@gmail.com. I love to get corrections. Garba, I guess the archaeologist, using a dating method based on cosmogenic nuclides, which are rare isotopes generated when high-energy cosmic rays collide with chemical elements and minerals on Earth's surface. They look at the concentrations of cosmogenic nuclides to reveal when a mineral was buried. I just feel like there's just so many variables. I don't know. Anyone know about cosmogenic nuclides? Maybe it's legit. Anyway. Okay, another thing that, oh yeah, this is last thing. A rare gray whale, which can be easily identified because he has no dorsal fin, that has been, it says, extinct in the Atlantic for 200 years, was spotted near Nantucket. So they were in the Atlantic, and then because of whaling or whatever, although, I mean, maybe, but the real extinction of whales, the real threat to whales, I used to read so many books on whaling, I just loved them. The real threat to whales was modern whaling, like high-powered harpoons and stuff. So 20th century whaling, you know, like was what the old style whaling did was just make them swim deeper. The new whaling like decimated them, probably way more than decimated them. So the gray whale was no longer in the North Atlantic for 200 years, it says. But now it reappeared. And the theory is, which is probably, I think it's right. I mean, I'm not a climate change, like a whatever, the climate alarmist story. But I do think that there is like actual evidence of Arctic ice melting. I think there are passages that weren't open before. And that's what they're saying these whales got through. Although, you know, you'd think they could swim under ice, but whatever. Too cold, maybe. It's not as cold. But the Arctic thing, Shannon, who might be here, sent me an article from, it's a 1966 NASA document that reveals the goal of engineered climate modification. And it has, I mean, it's oil companies from 100 years ago, more, were talking about how to get into the Arctic to see if there's oil there. Now, I didn't verify that. I don't know, but there's a lot of stuff in there that was documented in this thing, which will be in the show notes, that talks about efforts to melt Arctic ice. And I was interested in that because I was reading this new book came out, just mainstream publication, about tunnels under the Greenland ice sheet and how they wanted to build nuclear plants or I don't know what under there. And in this document, it says there were Arctic detonations of 88 atmospheric, 29 underground, and 3 underwater nuclear devices from 1955 to 1990. I mean, that alone, I would imagine, could have a permanent impact. I don't know if it did, but whatever's going on in the tunnels, I also looked at Antarctica, they said is warming up. I was like, I wonder if that's because of all the people. There's so much human activity in Antarctica. Like, they have a pollution problem and stuff. Mount Everest, too, in case you're wondering. But, yeah, so I believe that the Arctic ice is melting, and I think it was intentional. And I think they're exploiting it for oil. So I believe it. But, yeah, that cute little whale is, it was spotted 30 miles south of the Massachusetts island of Nantucket Friday, diving and resurfacing, appearing to feed. Anyway, so I think that's it. I hope you like the show. I've been trying to mix like deeper stories with some quick hits to get to all the articles and headlines that caught my eye. So if you do like the show, please do me the favor. Oh, hit the like button. Get yourself a notification. Listen, tune in at YouTube so you can engage with the comments Tuesdays and Thursdays at 2 o'clock Pacific, 5 o'clock Eastern. And if you want to listen to it on a podcast commercial free, for now, it's just on iTunes. It's a premium thing, $5 a month. But I'm going to open it up to all podcast platforms shortly. So stay tuned for that. And I don't need a lot of big bucks, just if you like the show, subscribe, leave a review, or, hit the like button. Thanks so much for coming. This is Monica Perez, and please enjoy my awesome adventure.